Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome back to Ruination, the Early Years. I'm King, and joining me as always is my expert guide through the marvelous chaos of Big Fatty Online.
Hello. Our mission today is a deep dive into the archives, and we're looking specifically at the week leading up to the final Friday in March 2008.
And this is a really pivotal period. It's a perfect storm.
It really is. You have Big Fatty balancing this post-holiday recovery. He's diving super deep into television nostalgia with this whole Cartoon Week thing. And at the same time, there's just an absolute explosion of podcast network drama.
Right. And critically, this is the week he starts plotting how to spend his unexpected, $600 economic stimulus money.
We've got a whole stack of BFO episodes to go through, starting with Easter Monday and going right through to that Friday, the Gaze segment.
We're going to cover everything. I mean, from his highly specific, almost ritualistic shopping habits and these, financial dreams of buying an iPhone.
All the way to this wild interview he does with Ryan, who's a new co-host preparing for Gay Days down in Orlando. We're really just summarizing this one week of Big Fatty Online, but concentrating intensely on his life and the stories he chooses to share.
And as always, we're going to unpack his incredible structural discipline.
For sure. I mean, how does he take these daily, often embarrassing domestic errands, like finally fixing a broken refrigerator light, and this truly bizarre fan mail, and successfully convert all of that into compelling, highly engaging daily content?
And we'll also look at the farcical consequences of his radical honesty, especially when that honesty is like weaponized against his old workplace enemies and these bureaucratic nightmares like airline agents.
It's a lot to get through.
Okay, let's unpack this. We open the week on Easter Monday, March 24th, and Big Fatty immediately grounds his sometimes extravagant persona in something just deeply universally relatable.
Post-holiday recovery and thriftiness.
Exactly. He opens the show by framing it around Easter Monday, which, is mainly a holiday in places like Canada and the UK.
But he's not really celebrating the holiday itself, right? He's celebrating the specific, immediate pleasure of getting half-price Easter candy.
And his justification is perfect. Mm-hmm. He just says, Big Fatty loves a coupon.
That tiny detail is so crucial because it immediately pulls you into his world. He's this chaotic, crude figure we all know, but he's also a meticulous shopper. He's always trying to maximize value.
It's that grounding budget consciousness that's always bubbling just beneath the surface of the performance.
For sure. And it's such a sharp contrast to what he was doing the previous Friday.
Yeah, he quickly recaps what he calls his horror event, which was an Easter basket raffle he held at Patrick's Pub. And it sounds... Well, it sounds decidedly unglamorous.
Decidedly. He describes it as a really low-key affair, and he makes a point of saying it was a very, very small crowd.
But even in those details, you get this crucial domestic and social context.
Oh, yeah. He confirms he enjoyed himself. He mentions having several of the good Tang and tonic with the double lime. And even with all that, it was still an early evening for him. He was home by 12:30 a.m.
But the transportation logistics are the real key here, I think. This whole thing sets the stage for the domestic situation that unfolds later in the week.
Precisely. His vehicle, the infamous X-Ford Explosion.
One of the iconic pieces of BFO lore, his SUV that's always breaking down.
That was being used by the NIP. And for anyone who doesn't know, that's his acronym, not in podcast. It's his internal code for a friend or partner whose identity he carefully protects.
So because the NIP has the car... He had to ride to the pub with his horror group.
Which we know consists of Larry Cly, Granny, and Miss Porter. These are his people. This is his closest social circle, the ones who show up to the small raffles. They're his anchor.
And the NIP is using the car because they were visiting a sick father up in Aiken. How does Big Fatty manage to turn that, pretty serious logistical detail of supporting a friend into part of the entertainment narrative?
He just states it as a fact, but he wraps it in his own context. The NIP's presence is structural. It affects who's driving who. It affects whether he can run around naked at home.
And as we'll see, it affects the state of his appliances.
Exactly. The fact that he's discussing this serious family matter happening elsewhere, visiting a sick father, it just shows that his life, even the serious parts, is always woven into the show's fabric. It reminds you that the Ruination is a performance layered on top of a very real, very supportive personal life.
And any reflection on Easter naturally leads to a moment of deep childhood nostalgia, which he handles with typical Big Fatty specificity.
Oh, yeah. He spends a moment on childhood Easter baskets, and the detail he pulls out is just so specific. His profound dislike of that cellophane grass getting into his mouth, he calls it nasty.
But then he offers this beautiful, almost tender detail about his mother's tradition.
It's lovely. Instead of the store-bought baskets, she would create a nest of green grass with a little papier-mâché rabbit standing in the middle. And the chocolate eggs and jelly beans were placed inside this nest,
allowing the children to pick at that during the weeks leading up to Easter.
Right. And this isn't just nostalgia. It reveals this consistent pattern of slow, deliberate consumption that, you know, it completely mirrors his shopping habits today. It's a moment of surprising vulnerability right in the middle of the booze recap.
Speaking of that domestic structure, when we move into the midweek, we see a shift as the NIP departs. Big Fatty is once again living alone.
And this brings on some classic BFO home anxiety, particularly around privacy and, I think, self-acceptance.
For sure. The NIP left early Tuesday morning, and Big Fatty immediately confesses his relief at being solitary again.
And his main reason is just perfect. He says he truly enjoys living alone because he can run around naked or just wear a camisole without the fear of people vomiting when they see him.
That radical honesty is always framed in self-deprecating humor.
Mm.
But the takeaway is clear, right? The ability to exist privately, totally unfiltered, is crucial to his well-being.
Even if that privacy is constantly under threat from his role as a public performer.
But the NIP's presence, however brief, also brought to light a micro saga that is just pure Big Fatty. The year-long battle with the refrigerator light.
Oh, the refrigerator light saga is an instant classic piece of domestic chaos.
It's a story about deferred maintenance, anxiety, and just ultimate absurdity.
He confesses that the light has been out for over a year, and he genuinely believed the bulb was, like, stuck or broken in the socket.
And the NIP, being the resourceful, grounded counterpart, suggests that classic trick. You buy a potato, you can use it to grip and remove a broken bulb.
Right. But when they actually tried it, the bulb just came right out, easily. It had never been stuck at all. He had simply avoided dealing with it for 12 months.
That avoidance is the key, isn't it? It's not just about a broken bulb. It's symbolic of all the little things he ignores until someone else intervenes.
Absolutely. And the irony is just perfected in the punchline. Big Fatty is now scared to open the refrigerator because after a year of blissful ignorance in the dark, he can finally see what's inside.
The ability to see his own mess, the reality of his domestic state, now constitutes a frightening moment for him.
It's a brilliant comedic structure. He takes a failure of simple maintenance and elevates it into an existential dread. The fix is worse than the problem because the fix requires accountability.
And that avoidance of reality connects perfectly to his financial situation, which is suddenly looking a little bit brighter.
He connects his sudden receipt of government aid directly to his desire for high-status technology. He announces he got a notice from the IRS that he's getting the $600 economic stimulus package.
Now, for many Americans, this is a lifeline, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for Big Fatty, it immediately transforms into capital for consumer desire.
He starts spending it in his head instantly. He's considering buying an iPhone with the money.
And this really highlights the iPhone fever that was sweeping the podcast network at the time. Why was this specific purchase so important to him right then?
It was the ultimate status tech of the era. I mean, you have to remember, Big Fatty often uses older, cheaper, or slightly obsolete technology, like that bag phone he's always talking about.
Yeah.
So buying an iPhone at that moment in 2008 was a major statement. It was a statement of modernity, of affluence, even if the funds came directly from a government stimulus check.
He's leveraging macroeconomics tax relief intended to stimulate the economy to fund a deeply personal desire for a status symbol.
And it's a statement that proves he's still relevant and technologically current within that whole RNL network. It's a fantastic blend of consumerism and political reality.
Yet amidst these high-tech dreams, he still gives us a classic, grounding shopping report. It's full of the details that make him so relatable.
It's the perfect anchor. It balances the iPhone fantasy with the reality of his daily routine. He meticulously details his shopping trip, securing a buy one, get one free deal on his coffee beans.
Which he makes sure to tell the audience he grinds himself. A small detail of domestic rigor.
Then we get the junk food report, which is equally specific. He bought Edie's Thin Mint ice cream, which was a new flavor at the time, and, critically, his beloved Stauffer's cream-chipped beef.
And his preparation ritual for the chipped beef is truly bizarre.
It's an art form. He confesses he likes to microwave it for about 8.5 minutes so that some of it gets burnt in the package.
He needs that slight caramelization.
That textural contrast between the creamy beef and the slightly crispy burnt edges. He also notes his preference for eating Samoas and thin mints frozen.
These tiny idiosyncratic rituals, they aren't just facts, they're intimacy. They're shared codes that tell the listener, I am specific, I am demanding, and I will tell you everything.
And that connection with the audience is solidified by the listener map, which is such a crucial structural component of BFO. It shows its growing global reach and dedicated participation.
He always dedicates time to this.
Yeah.
He lists new members who've joined, demonstrating the geographic spread. Deidre from Reno, Nevada. Ron from Kansas City.
Whom he affectionately calls a little cutie.
Right. Then trucker Alex from Colombia. Mark from Vancouver, British Columbia. And here he throws in that deep BFO cut, greeting the land of Dudley Durite.
And finally, Big John from Richlands, Virginia. This whole exercise transforms these anonymous listener numbers into real locations, real characters within the BFO world.
But there is one listener pin, the picture from Moose, that provides a moment of just pure, unexpected absurdity, the Moose mystery.
This is BFO using listener participation to generate new internal comedy. He singles out the picture from Moose in Raleigh, North Carolina.
And describes it as looking like a koala bear or something like that. It looks like it's getting ready to take a dump.
He urges listeners to go check the picture out on the website, confirming that the odd, slightly disgusting image seems appropriate for the BFO map. It's that constant search for the weird, the slightly gross detail that perfectly reflects his aesthetic of ruination.
Before he moves on, he also gives us a quick technical status report. He mentions Wes from the Live It Up podcast, updated his artwork, and he discusses his own continued use of the bag phone.
Right. And he clarifies that the bag phone isn't a modern cellular telephone. It's that old, clinky, but reliable satellite phone. He notes that some listeners still use them, and crucially, their bosses still use them because they're cheap.
He often uses older tech, but he owns it.
Totally. And this is where we get the technical detail that shows BFO is evolving into a more structured business thanks to the help of a listener.
Exactly. He gives a massive shout out to Larry H. Fader, who helped Big Fatty with Google Analytics this week.
And Big Sadie readily admits he doesn't fully understand it. He calls it a technical detail he's still trying to grasp. But the fact that he's incorporating it shows a key evolution.
He's treating BFO less like a diary and more like a scalable business.
He's serious about tracking his audience, even if he relies on Vader to interpret the metrics for him. He's delegating the technical complexities while maintaining all of the editorial and creative control.
So if part one was about the domestic anchor, part two immediately shoves us into the high-octane drama of public feuds and unfiltered judgments.
The legendary conflict with the Air Trans Airlines agent, Connie McCumley, or CMC, escalates dramatically this week into outright legal threats.
This whole saga is just a masterclass in committed narrative world building.
BFO plays a second voice letter, allegedly from Connie McCumley, the agent he'd feuded with over his missing bag. And she informs him she has hired an attorney from the, well, the highly suspicious-sounding firm, Dewey Cheatham & Howe.
Right.
To contact him regarding slanderous comments made on his program, she demands a restraining order against his nasty, nasty mouth.
This is amazing because he's taking what was clearly a fictionalized voice letter from the first time, and now he's treating it as this escalating legitimate legal threat, which only heightens the absurdity.
And she adds an update on the missing luggage. The bag is still being looked for, but the underpants, the famously soiled underpants, have in fact been returned.
So even the legal threat includes a progress report on the dirty laundry.
It literally grounds the legal fiction in domestic reality. It's just perfect.
But Big Fatty is not one to let a threat go unanswered. This legal threat is instantly countered by a pro-BFO, yet completely fictionalized, voice letter from an alleged family member of CMC.
Which raises the level of absurdity to a beautiful, farcical peak.
Enter the deep Southern theatrical tropes.
BFO plays a letter from Mrs. Dr. Harry Toulouse Twat, who identifies herself as the sister of Connie McCumley. And she's calling from Louisiana with the song Dixie playing loudly in the background.
Of course.
And she attempts to defend her sister by claiming the bag delay was due to Connie's affliction.
And the affliction is the key detail that justifies the theft, right?
Exactly. She claims Connie has a prediction to running her hands through the dirtiest stained and soiled undergarments of hot men.
Oh my God.
And Mrs. Dr. Harry Toulouse Twat suggests that Connie mistook Big Fatty's sack for belonging to a hot man. It takes a minor customer service dispute and transforms it into this high-drama, legal, and psychological narrative.
Using fabricated characters, regional stereotypes, and the running joke of Big Fatty's questionable sex appeal, it's satire performed through voice acting.
I have to ask, why do you think he resorts to such deep Southern tropes with these characters? Is he playing into a specific cultural caricature the audience expects, or is he genuinely venting?
I think it's definitely caricature. The voices he uses, especially that deep, exaggerated Southern accent playing Dixie, they're meant to invoke a specific, slightly backward, legally ambiguous part of America.
Suggesting the McCumley family operates outside of normal legal or behavioral boundaries.
Exactly. It elevates the AirTrans dispute from a personal grudge into a full-blown cultural battle between the polished modern podcaster and the ridiculous archaic bureaucracy represented by this family. It's highly effective.
And the phenomenon of the terrible service agent apparently transcends borders, as he shares an email detailing CMC's international parallel.
Confirming that bureaucratic incompetence is truly global.
He shares an email from Michael in Stuttgart, Germany. Michael deals with a German sister of CMC named Frieda from Freenet AG, and Frieda called his answer machine 6 times.
And just kept greeting, waiting, and asking questions to the answering machine without ever leaving a message.
It's an identical level of bureaucratic incompetence, but translated into German, just machine gun greeting the answering machine.
The detail that really brings this story home is the specific technical failure Michael endured.
Yes. Michael noted that Frieda's longest trial was 4 minutes of this back and forth with the answering machine's tone. And then after all that, Michael was disconnected when he tried to dial 1 to talk to a service team member.
So the ruin is truly global.
And the specific failure, the inability to properly use the technology of automated service, is the universal joke. Big Fatty loves finding confirmation that his petty grievances are shared worldwide.
So while he's fighting these fictional lawsuits, Big Fatty is still working at the coal mine, providing a constant stream of indispensable, unfiltered office gossip.
He proves that even after retirement, the drama of the workplace provides endless content. The coal mine, which is the nickname he gives to his actual workplace, is his petri dish for human failure.
And he recounts a deeply gross and shocking story about one of his colleagues, the BFB.
BFB stands for the Big Fat B, a recurring despised character in his office lore, the story. The BFB got to work today and she went to get out of the car and she S herself.
I mean, this is radical honesty combined with radical cruelty.
Absolutely. Big Fatty doesn't just report the incident. He expresses sheer, unadulterated delight at her misfortune, hoping she just absolutely just covered herself.
This is the kind of shocking, unfiltered office gossip that is BFO's trademark.
It fulfills the listener's expectation for high-impact shark content and cements Big Fatty's persona as someone who holds absolutely nothing back, even when discussing the physical humiliation of a coworker.
That willingness to cross a line, even when this absurd, is signature BFO. Does he ever give any indication that he self-censors?
Rarely. And when he does, it's usually for legal reasons or to protect the NIP. But when it comes to the BFB or the skull update, the hated receptionist, as we've discussed, there is no filter.
So this incident about the BFB isn't just a joke for him.
No, it's narrative payback for all the perceived slights he's endured at the coal mine. By publicly reporting and celebrating her utter ruin, Big Fatty regains a sense of control and superiority in a workplace he otherwise detests. It's revenge delivered via microphone.
He quickly shifts gears, weaving in cultural critique and media consumption, finding connections between his life, his body, and the shows he's watching.
The image of his terrifying refrigerator and the resulting shame immediately reminded him of the movie Run, Fat Boy, Run, which he discusses briefly. This is Big Fatty making his personal life the lens through which he views pop culture. Everything relates back to his own existence.
He critiques American Idol as well, focusing specifically on Paula Abdul's fashion choices.
He critiques her outfit, which he described as some sort of medieval armor or some kind of S like that with gauntlets. He finds it crazy. It's a very common BFO trope, noticing the bizarre fashion choices of celebrities and using them for observational humor.
It reminds us that he's paying attention to mainstream culture, even while he's operating on the fringes.
And then we get a random but highly specific philosophical inquiry from a listener.
Right. He shares a conversation he had with listener John from Italy about whether BFO would like to F Keith Olbermann.
Pure BFO. Taking a mainstream political figure and immediately sexualizing him for comedy and listener engagement. And then John from Ilya also recommended the book The Book Thief,
which Big Fatty shares with the audience, noting that John said it was kind of crazy in the beginning but would make you teary-eyed later.
It's a fascinating contrast, isn't it? The dark sexual humor immediately followed by a serious literary recommendation. It shows the wide, often contradictory range of topics BFO can successfully cover.
Moving into part three, we dive into one of the week's critical structural pillars, Cartoon Week. This provided the necessary nostalgia, trivia, and pacing to break up the intense domestic and legal drama.
Cartoon Week, or Memory Lane Music, is a hallmark of BFO structure. It's a daily segment dedicated to obscure or classic theme songs, and it provides fascinating trivia that only someone obsessed with 60s and 70s Hanna-Barbera could deliver.
He uses this segment not just for music, but for cultural archiving. Let's start with Monday's selection, Top Cat.
On Monday, he featured the theme from Top Cat, and he notes it ran for a surprisingly short run, only 30 episodes from 1961 to 1962.
But the depth comes in the character analysis.
Oh, yeah. He lists the full cast: TC, Fancy Fancy, Spook, Benny the Ball, The Brain, Choo Choo, and Officer Charlie Dibble. For the listener, this isn't just a list, it's a moment of shared memory. It proves that Big Fatty's brain is a vast repository of useful, if completely irrelevant, cultural knowledge.
Tuesday brought a speed racer.
And Big Fatty was forward-looking here. He used the segment to predict a forthcoming movie, which, of course, eventually proved correct. This shows his sense of cultural prescience. He knew which beloved properties were ripe for adaptation.
But Wednesday delivered a truly deep cut, the kind of show that separates the casual listener from the dedicated BFO aficionado, Beanie and Cecil.
This is the highlight. Big Fatty admitted he would sing along, always ensuring he ended the theme song with the word cartoon, just like Cecil did. It's a perfect piece of audio theater.
He gives all the details, too.
Meticulously. He explains it ran in 1962, consisting of 26 shows, 78 cartoons. The character details are all there. Beanie was the cherub-faced boy with the beanie copter, and Cecil the C6 sea serpent, who had a distinctive lisp and a Super Cecil alter ego.
And his description of the captain is equally specific.
Yes. Captain Horatio Huff and Puff, known as Uncle Captain, was the captain of the Leaking Lena. This isn't just trivia, it's BFO providing historical context for a specific era of animation, an era characterized by simple, recognizable characters and repetitive structural comedy.
His meticulous attention to this obscure TV history is a hallmark of the show's intellectual curiosity.
Despite the rest of the content being about dirty underwear and shigging yourself in the parking lot.
Exactly. The second half of part three focuses on the voice letter roundup, which reveals a pattern that gives Big Fatty cause for immediate complaint, what he calls podcaster envy.
Right. He notes the high volume of voice letters, but he's frustrated because they are primarily coming from people already involved in the podcasting community.
It's leading to these meta discussions about the network instead of listener feedback. He wants genuine grassroots engagement.
We see this with Eric the Southern Boy, who called in with a highly flattering but dismissed suggestion.
Eric called Big Fatty sexy and asked if they were going to do a video cast, a video version of the show.
And Big Fatty immediately dismisses the idea, calling Eric delusional. But the network dynamics are fascinating here. Eric then played a clip on his own show, urging his listeners to call Big Fatty's bag phone.
So it becomes a chain reaction. One podcaster uses another's criticism to generate content and drive calls. Big Fatty loves the traffic, even if he hates the specific messenger.
BFO then names the primary podcasters calling in Nessa, DJ David J, Tom, Chef Mark, AA, and Super B, and he throws down a direct challenge to his core audience.
He demands a revolt.
This is a direct attempt to steer the conversation away from the echo chamber.
Huh.
He demands that the listeners, the non-podcasters, the civilian audience, revolt and call the bag phone.
And he backs this up with humor and slightly veiled threats.
Saying, don't make me give you the finger, or don't make me drive up and beat the S out of JT up in Chicago. It's an explicit use of humor and performance-based threats to actively manage listener engagement.
We got a highly memorable update on network lore and physical attributes from Chef Mark.
Chef Mark called in after Big Fatty mentioned him on The Gaze with Tim. Chef Mark confirmed that while he is short, much shorter than Tim, he believes they are the same size.
And in the vernacular of BFO and The Gaze, this, of course, means a huge penis.
Of course. This is BFO using the physical attributes of its network peers for locker room humor, community bonding, and establishing the specific crude code of conduct within the RNL network.
And the other podcasters reinforce the specific kind of humor BFO trades in.
Tom the Ramble Redhead called in praising Big Fatty's laugh and confirming his love for dark humor by mentioning a past joke about Midget the Hammered. This is the audience signaling approval for boundary-pushing jokes.
And Super B called in to talk about Race Bannon from Johnny Quest as his moment I knew I was gay.
Which is BFO acting as an archive for these shared cultural awakenings, where fictional characters become touchstones for identity.
All this intense network engagement and focus naturally leads to travel planning and a network meetup.
Big Fatty thanks Eric West, the host of the Beat San Francisco podcast, for the skull update, referring to the despised coal mine receptionist. It confirms that even the smallest grudge has an audience outside of his own state.
Then he announces a San Francisco meet and greet for listeners, scheduled for the week of July 4th through the 10th. He suggests the location will likely be The Edge, or someplace like that down in the Castro.
And this announcement comes with an immediate challenge to a specific listener.
Yes. He challenges Eric West, who is known to be a straight listener of the show, to feel comfortable enough to attend one of the homosexual establishments.
This isn't meant to be exclusionary. It's a provocation. It's Big Fatty telling his entire audience, regardless of orientation, that the BFO event will be held in his world on his terms. Everyone is welcome, but they must be prepared to step outside their comfort zone.
That brings us to part four, the Friday the Gays segment, which features a crucial interview with Ryan, a listener who's become a key co-host, setting the stage for a massive summer party.
Ryan is a fascinating new entry point into the BFO universe. He's a listener from New York who met his partner, Jason, a longtime BFO listener from Orlando, 4 years ago in the Orlando Gay Chorus.
This background immediately establishes Ryan as a BFO success story. The podcast leads to community, which leads to romance.
And the segment opens with classic BFO technical chaos.
Absolutely. The recording begins after 45 minutes of failure, which Big Fatty immediately claims he ruined. The technical chaos is not a bug. It's structural to the show. It proves the BFO is raw and unedited.
Ryan uses this interview to announce the launch of his new podcast, showing the constant growth and splintering of the BFO network.
Me and Jason are launching their own podcast the way we see it next Wednesday.
And Ryan describes it as an audio personal podcast about how Jason and I just hate the world, basically.
Yeah.
This is BFO's direct lineage, taking personal relationships and turning them into commentary, often focusing on shared misanthropy. It confirms the network is thriving by replicating Big Fatty's core content model.
Ryan also quickly establishes his network status.
He confirms he's met Superb Kevin from QCast, noting he'd seen his Lederhosen pictures, but he hasn't met British John yet. This places him firmly within the network hierarchy and orbit before his show even launches.
One of the most insightful parts of the segment is how Big Fatty drills down on Ryan's home life. It reveals the difficulties of being a podcaster with a non-podcaster partner.
This is the crux of the segment. It highlights that ever-present tension between the public ruined persona and the requirement for private stable relationships.
Ryan's husband, a real estate agent, hates podcasting and thinks I'm obsessed. He sees it as a drain on time and energy.
Yet the husband is also incredibly nosy. The public-private boundary completely breaks down because Big Fatty receives instant messages from the husband during the recording.
Sending the word A and confirming who makes the best margaritas.
So the partner who despises the medium can't stop listening and engaging, effectively turning his resistance into material for the show he hates.
It's the ultimate feedback loop. The husband's inability to stop listening and commenting, even with insults, confirms Big Fatty's power over the domestic sphere. The resistance to the podcast is instantly and effectively turned into highly entertaining content.
And it kind of justifies Ryan's commitment to the medium. Even the arguments become show material.
The iPhone device surfaces again, directly connecting Ryan's affluence to Big Fatty's $600 stimulus money plan.
Ryan reveals he has an iPhone, which was bought by his partner as an I'm sorry gift. Another tiny, intimate detail instantly converted to content.
And Big Fatty, already intensely jealous about his own stimulus plan, immediately jokes about Ryan needing to send him an iPhone as a present.
This comparison is fascinating. Big Fatty sees the iPhone as a status symbol purchased through government aid, whereas Ryan received his through domestic conflict and reconciliation. Both paths lead to the same desirable status tech.
The main focus of the segment, though, is the massive event Ryan is hosting, which Big Fatty is promoting as a network meetup.
Ryan confirms major plans for Gay Days in Orlando happening in June, July. He's hosting a party on the Sunday of Gay Days, usually a naked volleyball party, and he specifically encourages Big Fatty not to wear a bathing suit.
This is a deliberate push for radical acceptance and participation. you must be ready to shed your inhibitions, literally.
They plan to have a cheap gay bartender, which they clarify means inexpensive and a bit of both in terms of physical appeal. The mix of budget consciousness and sexual appetite is classic BFO.
They cover their drink preferences, which prompts yet another instant message from the nosy partner.
Ryan likes Captain Morgan and Sprite or margaritas, while the boyfriend likes vodka effect, which, again, immediately prompts an IM from the husband, proving he is hanging on every single word.
They even discuss Orlando landmarks for future meetups, noting the Apple Store is located near the Holy Land theme park.
And Big Fatty, ever the provocateur, suggests the Holy Land theme park as a potential location for a listener meet and greet.
Yes, he sarcastically calls it the Holy Land and suggests it as a meeting spot, taking a sacred location and juxtaposing it with the hedonism of gay days and the technological consumerism of the nearby Apple Store.
It's an effective piece of satire, forcing these disparate cultural elements, faith, commerce, and sexuality, to clash within the Orlando landscape.
The segment wraps up with Ryan confirming his show schedule.
Ryan will podcast once a week, aiming, he jokes, to annoy his husband the whole time, a goal that we know will be fulfilled given the husband's inability to ignore the conversation.
Big Fatty ends the segment reminding listeners about April 1st being National Go Get a New Listener for the BFO Day, pushing for audience growth through direct action, even amidst all the chaos.
What a comprehensive week. I mean, we saw Big Fatty turn financial relief, the $600 stimulus, into iPhone envy and use the mundane details of domestic life. The NIP leaving, the terrifying fridge light, into highly engaging serialized content.
All this while navigating an escalating farcical legal threat from an airline agent's fictional family.
And throughout the chaos of Cartoon Week nostalgia, the gross-out coal mine gossip, and the planning of this giant Orlando party, the show's structure held fast. It proves that the daily dose of BFO, whether discussing BFB bathroom issues or 60s cartoon trivia, was indispensable.
He is constantly creating a shared cultural archive for his audience.
But here's where it gets really interesting, I think. The NIP's careful anonymity and Ryan's openly nosy and resistant husband both highlight this intense tension between Big Fatty's ruined public persona and the absolute necessity for separate private relationships.
Right. His closest friends and partners exist outside the explicit BFO universe.
Yet he constantly turns their lives, their conflicts, and their logistical demands into content, often without their full knowledge or explicit permission.
That is the ultimate cost of radical honesty and performance, isn't it?
It is. I mean, consider Ryan's husband, who actively dislikes the podcast, but cannot stop listening or sending notes. Big Fatty demands radical honesty from his audience, yet he's built an entire world that requires others in his intimate circle to pretend they aren't part of it, or to resist it openly, simply to protect his own sense of domestic peace.
It's a real paradox.
So I leave you with this. If you were Big Fatty's partner, could you tolerate the reality that every fight, every mundane detail, and every bit of technical chaos is immediately converted into material for thousands of listeners? How does the performance of Ruination ultimately affect the relationships of the people who are not performing?
Yeah, it's definitely something to chew on. This has been King.
And I'm Gail.
Tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years.
We'll see you then.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.